Chapter 4 Eve looked across the table at the red-haired detective with the nasal, grating northern voice and wished she'd just fuck off and leave her alone. At this particular point in time, she didn't care who'd killed her father. All that mattered was that he was dead and that she'd be alone with nobody to hold her when she was miserable or make her laugh when she needed cheering up. Her anger was undirected, or perhaps more directed towards him for leaving her than at the person or persons who'd made it happen. But Eve was polite. She'd been well brought up by her parents. So she sat at the big table in the shadowy, cool kitchen, and she drank tea, and she answered the intruder's questions.
"Tell me about the other residents," the detective, Jen Rafferty, said. "I've met Wesley, but I don't know the others."
"John and Sarah Grieve. They've got twins, Daisy and Lily. They're very cute. The girls, I mean, not the parents."
"How old are the kids?"
"Just 7. They had their birthday a couple of weeks ago. We had a party.
My dad came with balloons. Different presents for each of the girls. I made a cake."
"What role do the parents play here at Westercombe? How do they fit in?"
"John's a farmer and Sarah runs the dairy. She also looks after Frank's house now that his mother's dead, does his laundry, stuff like that. Things are tight for them financially, and he pays her well to do it. She never stops working, even though she's pregnant again."
Eve paused for a moment. Sometimes Sarah's energy made her feel incompetent, idle.
"Even now she's making plans. She'd like to open a tea shop alongside the dairy. That would bring more people in and give Wes and me a chance to sell more of our stuff."
Eve wondered why she was even mentioning that. She'd been excited when Sarah had first thrown out the idea, but now, what importance could it possibly have?
"Were Sarah and John at the drinks party with Mr. Lay yesterday evening?"
"Yeah, and the kids for a while. Halfway through, Sarah took them away and put them to bed. She came back later and John went to babysit. He's not exactly sociable and I think he was glad to escape."
Eve paused for a moment but decided to continue. Better to give the woman all the information she needed, and then she might be left in peace to cry and howl without an audience. Sometimes she felt like glass, which was pliable and easy to mold when it was hot. She could be amiable and pleasant until the stress built up. Then, like glass, she became cold and hard, and she'd crack under the slightest pressure. She didn't want to crack in front of the detective.
Wes was there too, but just for a while. He'd obviously had a better offer but felt the need to show his face, to keep Frank sweet.
"Frank is Francis Lay?"
"Yeah, of course."
Jesus, what's wrong with this woman? She's supposed to be a detective. I've already told her that.
"What time did the party break up?"
"It wasn't really a party, just a few drinks. If anything, it was a kind of business meeting."
"In what way?"
"Sarah brought up her idea of opening a tea shop. Obviously, we'd have to get Frank's approval. There's spare space by the side of the dairy, which would be ideal, but we couldn't go ahead without him."
"What did he say?"
"It was a bit disappointing, actually. He said he'd never envisaged this place becoming so commercial. He was worried about access and parking. It's okay for him, though. He's minted. He doesn't need to be commercial."
The detective was scribbling in a notebook, and Eve felt compelled to add,
"Of course, it's Frank's place, and we're lucky to be here. He doesn't charge anything close to the going rent. It obviously has to be his decision."
She wouldn't like to come across as ungrateful. Even now, she realized, with her father stabbed, looking like a slaughtered animal, his body still on the studio floor being mauled by strangers, she was worrying about what people thought of her.
"So, there was this discussion over drinks," Jen Rafferty said.
"How did it end?"
"With Frank asking Sarah to draw up proper plans. He said he'd think about it, and we all drifted away about 9. Sarah went back to the cottage."
"And you?"
The woman looked up from her notebook. The red fringe almost hid intense brown eyes.
"I went to the studio for an hour, then I went home too, to my flat in the loft. I was in bed by 10:30.
"You didn't hear from your father at all during the evening? He didn't say he planned to come over?"
Eve shook her head.
There's no phone reception in the studio, but there were no missed messages or calls. I checked before I went to bed.
There was a moment of silence. The detective seemed to be choosing her words carefully.
You saw how your father was killed?
Eve couldn't speak. The image of bloody glass flashed like faulty neon in her head. It occurred to her that she might never be able to work with the material again. But there had to be a response. She nodded.
That piece of glass, did you recognize it? Was it something you made?
The picture appeared again, like something from one of the arty films she sometimes dragged her father to see at the woodyard, all flashbacks and jerky cuts.
Yes. I'd been commissioned to make a couple of vases for a smart new shop in Ilfracombe. Tall, green, big enough to hold lilies. The shard came from one of those.
She'd been so proud when they were finished. Just the shade of green she'd been looking for. Supremely elegant.
I assume it hadn't been broken when you last saw it.
No, they were both on the shelf in the corner when I left the studio. I'd agreed to deliver them on Monday.
Again, she pictured the scene.
One of them is still there. They were as identical as pieces of handcrafted glass could be.
The sun must have shifted because a beam was shining through the window, lighting dancing motes of dust.
I'm sorry.
And Jen Rafferty did sound genuinely sorry for these questions, for making Eve relive the moment of finding her dad. It seemed she understood the anguish she was causing.
Eve thought that in different circumstances, she and Jen Rafferty might even get on. Eve had done her MA in the Glass Centre in Sunderland and had liked the Northerners she'd met there. Something about Jen took her back to that space on the Weir, perhaps the most creative and happiest time in her career. But she didn't want to start crying again, and she tried to rekindle her earlier resentment. Anger was easier than overwhelming grief.
Have you finished?
The question was so sharp that it was almost rude.
Nearly.
Jen paused.
Can you think of anyone who would have wanted your father dead?
Of course not. This was close to laughable. He was kind, gentle, understanding. He'd spent most of his career as a doctor specializing in end-of-life care.
And more recently for an organization which investigated his former colleagues and poked around in their business. Jen said.
That could have been tricky, if he was investigating them. He hadn't made enemies through his work.
He never spoke about work.
That was true, Eve thought, but not quite the full story, and perhaps this detective deserved the full story.
He found it stressful, more stressful than medicine. I don't think he found managing a small team of bitchy women easy. When he took it on, he said the job was important. Another way of saving lives, but challenging.
And recently? Jen prompted. Had it become more challenging recently?
Something was puzzling him.
Just puzzling? Or worrying?
That was when Eve realized that this woman wasn't stupid as she'd first thought, because of course Jen was right. Very recently her father had been worried. He'd tried to hide it, but she'd felt the unusual tension. Seen the dark rings under his eyes, which suggested he hadn't been sleeping well. There'd been moments of joy, too, and she'd wondered about the strange mood swings.
Eve nodded.
Yes, she said. I think something at work was troubling him. He'd become obsessed by it, but he wouldn't talk about it. He couldn't.
Confidentiality, Jen said easily. Of course. He'll have kept records, though, and I assume he'll have discussed it with his colleagues and patients together. You can leave all that to us.
Eve didn't say anything, but it seemed to her that it might have been the team which had triggered her father's anxiety. That was guesswork, though, instinct, and she wasn't sure how she'd put her feelings into words. In the end, she didn't need to speak, because the kitchen door flew open, letting in a blast of sunshine, and Sarah, Earth Mother extraordinaire, and possibly her closest friend. After a couple of miscarriages, this time all seemed to be well with Sarah's pregnancy. She was round and short, and she was wearing a cheesecloth smock over a patchwork skirt of her own design with an expanding elasticated waist.
Eve always thought Sarah looked as if she'd stepped straight out of the 70s.
"Oh, Evie," she said. "I've just heard. I mean, I saw the police cars when I came back from taking the girls to gymnastics and all the fuss, but none of them would tell me what was going on. Frank came to the cottage to fill us in. He'd been talking to a policeman."
She sat beside Eve and put her arms around her. Eve smelled the henna Sarah used to dye her hair and a faint bass note of cow. Eve pulled herself gently away and thought that Sarah was a bit like a cow herself, placid and wide-eyed. Soon she would be full of milk.
"This is Detective Sergeant Rafferty."
She nodded across the table towards Jen. "She's been asking me some questions."
"Oh."
Sarah turned her attention to Jen, and Eve was aware of her friend's ritual hostility to the police. She was already bristling.
"Don't you think this is a bit soon to be hassling her? She's only just lost her father."
Jen didn't quite roll her eyes. Eve had a moment of amusement and then felt guilty to be enjoying the standoff between the women.
"It's okay," Eve said. "Really, I want to help find out what happened.
And besides, we're finished for now." The detective smiled at Eve.
"If you think of anything, though, give me a shout, any time. Here's my card."
Jen got to her feet, stood for a moment silhouetted in the doorway, the bright light behind her, and then she disappeared.
"Come into the cottage."
Sarah could have been bossing around one of the twins.
"I can get you tea, wine, whatever you need. You can't be alone at a moment like this."
Eve was tempted to go along with the idea. Politeness was a habit. But really, she couldn't stand the idea of Sarah's cluttered house, kids' toys and shoes everywhere, half-finished craft projects, half-eaten plates of food. The dairy was always immaculate, but the cottage was her idea of a nightmare.
"To be alone is absolutely what I need," she said, her voice firm. "It's kind of you to offer, but it's been a shock and I need some time."
"Are you sure?" Sarah hated to be alone, but knew her friend well enough to understand how different they were.
"Certain."
To make her point, Eve stood up and made her way into the main body of the house and to what had once been the servants' stairs leading to her attic flat. She climbed slowly and pushed open the door, which was never locked. She'd left all the windows open, and a breeze blew the curtains into the room. She lay on her bed and began to cry again.
Chapter 5. Matthew was standing in the yard, in the corner, which was as far away from Eve's studio as he could get. He'd always been an observer, on the outside looking in, and hated the thought of getting in the way of the CSIs just to make his presence felt. The investigators could pass on all they knew at the evening briefing. Jen came out of the kitchen and walked towards him.
"How did you get on?" Matthew said. "Anything useful?"
He'd still been thinking of the conversation with Lay and was attempting to process the information about Yo's investigation into the treatment of the boy who'd killed himself. Now he'd tried to clear his mind so he could listen properly to anything she might have to say.
"I have a better idea of what's going on here, how the place runs."
Jen paused. "I can't see a reason why anyone here might have wanted to kill Yo, but according to his daughter, there was something worrying him at work. That would explain why he wanted to speak to me."
Jen looked up. "If I'd been more together last night, he might have told me then. All this..."
She swept her arm to take in the CSI vehicles and the blue and white tape.
"Might have been avoided?"
Matthew shook his head. "If he had a concrete suspicion, he'd have reported it to one of the bosses in the Health Trust, the organization that runs all the North Devon hospitals, or he'd have come to us officially. I don't think he'd have discussed it with you at a social gathering."
"Perhaps it wasn't concrete. No proof, but a suspicion. A sense that something wasn't quite right."
"Maybe. We'll certainly need to speak to his colleagues."
"Do you want me to do that now? I could go to the hospital?"
"Dr. Yo wasn't based in the hospital. He was quite independent of the trust. I've discovered that the NDPT worked out of a small office in Ilfracombe." Matthew had tried phoning, but the call had gone straight to an automated voicemail. "They work office hours."
"You must have worked closely with the Health Trust, though. I could talk to them."
Matthew thought about priorities. Jen always liked instant action,
but he wanted to know more about Yo's role before confronting the man's colleagues or any health service officials. He shook his head. Our focus should be here for the moment. Ross and I are about to talk to your pal Wesley. Francis Leigh thought he heard him coming back early this morning, but he hasn't emerged yet. Obviously, that's not an interview for you because he's a friend. Can you talk to the Greaves? We need a statement from them. Jen nodded. I met the woman briefly when I was talking to Eve. And? Very hippy-dippy. Not a huge fan of the police. Matthew smiled. I'm sure you can persuade her that we don't eat babies. Jen seemed about to reply, but she said nothing. Ross had been chatting to Brian Branscombe, the crime scene manager, and sauntered over. Ready when you are, boss. As if he'd been waiting for Matthew and not the other way around. There were times when he still managed to come across as cocky, arrogant. Well, thank you, Detective Constable. Sorry to keep you. Ross only nodded, not recognizing the sarcasm. Matthew couldn't help smiling. Matthew had checked the layout of the house with Leigh. They went through the kitchen and climbed narrow wooden stairs to a corridor, dimly lit by a dusty skylight. At one end was a door to Eve Yo's flat, and at the other the entrance to Wesley's. Matthew knocked and heard a faint groan inside. He took that as an invitation to enter and pushed his way in. Ross followed. They walked straight into a sitting room with a sloping roof and two small dormer windows. There was a sink, a fridge, and a microwave at one end. The rest of the room could have been a student pad from the 60s or 70s. A couple of sofas were covered by Indian throws. There were posters on the walls, celebrating bands Matthew had never heard of. Rush mats on the floor, a guitar propped against a chair. The faint but unmistakable smell of cannabis. Matthew was struck by the fact that Leigh's tenants seemed stuck in a time and a place that would have seemed unreal to Ross and his generation. This would be ancient history, where the values were entirely different. Ross had worked hard for his mortgage, his tidy house, the two cars on the drive, and the annual holiday in the sun. He would despise the chaos and the lack of security. Matthew's husband Jonathan would understand it, though. He'd feel at home here. For a moment, Matthew felt caught in the middle, in a time warp, tugged two ways. Hello? Matthew shouted.
Who is it?
The voice from the bedroom was muffled, groggy. The police.
Shit.
A pause.
Just a minute.
He'd obviously pulled on the jeans and t-shirt he'd been wearing the night before, just because they were the first things that had come to hand. They were crumpled, looked as if they'd been snatched from a pile on the floor. Through the open bedroom door, Matthew could see the heap of unwashed clothes. The bed was low, covered again by Indian cotton, this time unhemmed, frayed at one edge. Without Wesley, it was empty. That made things less complicated. Matthew had thought the man might have brought home a companion, someone he'd met at Cynthia Pryor's party.
What's going on, man?
Wesley Curnow pulled back his long, dark hair into a ponytail.
I had a heavy night.
He gave a smile, which Matthew took as an instinctive attempt to charm or ingratiate.
Must be my age. I never got a hangover when I was younger.
We're investigating a murder.
What?
He stopped in his tracks, arms still raised to pull the hair through an elastic band.
You're kidding, right?
He moved to the kitchen bench and flicked a switch on the kettle. Coffee? Tea? No, thank you. Matthew didn't give Ross a chance to reply.
Look, you better sit down, I'm sorry. It was a late one last night and I'm not really with it.
A pause while he made instant coffee before turning back to them.
Who's dead?
Nigel Yo, Eve's father.
No!
He sat heavily on the sofa opposite them, his mug of coffee in his hand.
Fuck! I thought you were going to say some stranger. I don't know, an ancient body hidden in the woods or on the common. Not someone I actually knew. Oh God, Eve, how is she?
Matthew ignored the last question. How well did you actually know Nigel?
Quite well. He came to visit Eve most weekends, helped her with the glass and had become almost a partner. He bought a few of my pieces. I liked him a lot.
Wesley paused, noisily drank coffee, then looked up, shocked.
I saw him last night. He was at a party in Barnstable. It was a surprise to see him there, but he's not the partying type. A bit like Eve, who can't think of anything except her work. But it was thrown by a neighbour, so perhaps he was just there to be polite.
Or to speak to my sergeant about a case that was troubling him.
What time did you get home?
I'm not sure, not super late. 1:30? I took a while mooching back up the lane.
Matthew nodded. He was in bed by 11 unless he was working. Jonathan would have considered 1 not super late too, and he was learning to adjust his ideas, to be more open-minded about other people's habits.
Did you notice anything unusual when you were on your way in?
Nigel was killed here.
Again, the man seemed horrified by a murder so close to home.
Yes, in his daughter's studio. Matthew thought there could be no harm in passing on this information. The man only had to look out of his window to see what was going on.
Wesley sat with his hands cupped around the mug. He had the body of a young man, but this close, Matthew could see he was approaching middle age. There were lines on his forehead and around his eyes. He looked tired, washed out.
I got a lift back to Instow with a friend and walked up the lane from there. It was dark, of course, but there was a bit of a moon and I enjoyed the exercise. Still a bit pissed, but in a good way, you know? Euphoric, full of plans, music in my head. I wandered off the track for a bit and just sat at the edge of a field. It'd just been cut for hay and there was that wonderful smell. I could have got drunk just on that. I was looking out at the estuary and the lights on the opposite shore, putting together some words for a song.
We'll need the name of your friend.
Janie McKenzie. Her dad runs the bar by the beach in Instow. We're old pals, play some music together. Hook up every now and again when she's bored or she doesn't have a better offer.
Wesley found his phone in his jeans pocket, looked at it and gave Matthew the number. Another connection. Janie must be Mac's sister. The pretty, lively one everybody likes.
She didn't offer to give you a lift all the way.
Nah. Wesley gave a wry smile. She'd had enough of me by then. Janie's not the sort to do favours.
So you walked all the way back from the main road.
He shrugged. It was a beautiful evening and I'm used to it.
He paused.
It's only a mile or so. There was a car coming in the opposite direction down from the farm. I was in the middle of the road. That time of night you don't expect to see anyone.
It must have freaked them out too. I jumped into the hedge and they slammed on the brakes. Missed me by inches.
Can you tell me anything about the car?
Wesley shook his head. I was blinded by the headlights. It was going fast. Too fast for the road, even though there was no other traffic about. It disappeared down the hill and I pulled myself out of the hedge covered by bloody nettle stings.
He held out his arm, but the stings seemed to have faded.
And this would have been about 1 o'clock?
Even later than that. I was nearly home.
Anything unusual when you got here?
I didn't notice anything, but I was still a bit shaken after my close encounter with mortality.
He leaned back and closed his eyes. Matthew thought he was trying to picture the scene, the late-night starlit farmyard. Ross was restless and seemed about to throw in a question of his own, but Matthew motioned for him to stay quiet.
Wesley's eyes opened. I'm pretty sure there weren't any lights on in the building. I'd have noticed. Sarah is like the planet police and gives us grief over any wasted energy. Eve follows the rules, so it would have struck me if she'd left a light on in her studio. Everything was quiet. I let myself into the kitchen and came up to the flat.
You and Eve have keys to the kitchen door.
Yes, that's how we get into the house. Frank has the rest of the space and uses the front door overlooking the garden.
What about the studios? Are they kept locked?
Matthew thought Jen would have asked about that, but it was worth checking.
Yes, even though most of my work uses stuff that people are trying to get rid of, my tools cost a fortune. Nobody much finds their way here, but I wouldn't take the risk. And Eve's the same about her place. Some of her commissions take hours to make, and her equipment is worth a bomb. Her dad bought the furnace as a 21st birthday present.
Matthew thought that made sense.
Would Nigel have had a key?
Yeah, almost certainly. He kept an eye on the place when Eve went away. She's got uni mates in Exeter and spends weekends with them sometimes.
Did you see Dr. Yeo's car in the yard when you arrived back from the party?
Wes shook his head.
Well, that doesn't mean it wasn't there. We all park in the far corner so John can get his tractor through, and that's in shadow.
Matthew would have liked to close his eyes now, to run through various scenarios. Nigel's car had been found in the yard, so he'd driven here. Jen had said that he'd hardly had anything to drink at the party. Had he arranged to meet someone? Why here and not his home in Barnstable? But a detective inspector couldn't look as if he was sleeping in the middle of an interview, so he kept his eyes open and stood up. I think that's all we need for now. I'm sure we'll have other questions.
Of course, come any time.
He seemed very relieved that they were leaving. Matthew wondered if that was because of the cannabis, or because the man had something more important to hide. Chapter 6. In the low white house by the shore, Jonathan was enjoying a lazy Saturday morning. Matthew was at work. He'd been woken very early by his phone. Jonathan had got up too, made coffee for them both while Matthew showered. Then, as soon as he'd heard his husband's car drive away down the toll road, Jonathan had gone back to bed. He'd woken again to full sunlight streaming through the open window, the long call of herring gulls and the sound of waves on the beach. Somewhere in the distance, a dog was barking. At this time of year, Crow Point attracted lots of dog walkers. Now he was in the kitchen planning. The following day, Matthew's mother would be coming for Sunday lunch. Such a simple event was fraught with difficulties. They'd invited her before, but she'd always refused. Too proud or too bigoted to meet her son's husband. Or too anxious, Jonathan thought, about what her friends in the small, tight, uptight religious community to which she belonged might think. More worried about appearances than her son's happiness. Matthew had grown up in the same community, and despite rejection, seemed not to have a strong sense of resentment against the brethren. There was more a cold reluctance to engage, either with his former friends or with his mother. Tomorrow would be her birthday. Jonathan had issued the invitation in writing, in a card, and a small formal note of acceptance had been sent back. That was when he'd told Matthew what he'd done, and Matthew had been worried about it ever since. Matthew was a worrier in every situation. He'd rushed off to his murder scene this morning almost with a sense of relief. Work would be a distraction. Jonathan would cook, of course. He loved cooking and sometimes had dreams of leaving the woodyard and setting up a restaurant, something unpretentious and welcoming to celebrate local food. He knew he'd never do it, though. The woodyard, the arts centre and community hub on the banks of the Tor in Barnstable was his baby, his creation. He'd found the funds, set it up, and from the magical opening evening he'd managed it. Now he couldn't imagine life without it. Lunch would have to be a roast, because it would be a Sunday, and Dorothy Venn would expect it. She'd be traditional in her tastes. He'd never met her, but he thought he knew her. And a roast would make Matthew happy. Jonathan was almost entirely veggie these days, and because he did most of the cooking, so was Matthew, at home at least. A large slab of meat, a rib of beef perhaps, would be a treat, and it would give Jonathan the chance to show off his Yorkshire puddings. Afterwards there would be cake. A special birthday cake, still to be decided on. Something spectacular, with a lot of whipped cream and the first strawberries from the garden. He made more coffee and went outside to sit and drink it, lazing on the wrought iron bench with its view of the estuary. He was wearing shorts and sandals, and the sun was already hot on his bare legs. He was writing a shopping list, planning his trip into town, when his mobile rang. It was one of the young craftspeople he had encouraged to exhibit in the woodyard when it had first opened, and he was looking for the support of younger artists. Soon afterwards, Eve Yeo had become more than another work contact. They'd become friends when her mother was in the final stages of Alzheimer's disease, close to death. Eve had come into his office one day and burst into tears, spilled out her grief and her guilt and her rage. He'd comforted her, and she had come back a few weeks later with a jug made from cloudy blue glass with a clear twisted handle. Just to say thank you. He'd gone to Helen Yeo's funeral a fortnight later. Now Jonathan was pleased to hear from her. He was proud that she liked to keep in touch. He wasn't quite old enough to be Eve's father, but if he'd had a child, he'd have loved them to be someone like her. Passionate, creative. He loved her energy and her dedication to her art.
Hi, Eve.
Can I meet you? They got together occasionally on Saturday mornings for coffee in George Mackenzie's bar in Instow, but plans for the meal were still at the forefront of his mind. He never liked to rush when he was creating.
Sure, he said easily. One day next week?
I was hoping you'd be able to see me today. Something rather dreadful has happened. I need to get away from Westercombe for a while."
Only now could Jonathan tell how upset she was. She was just about holding it together. He didn't want to pry over the phone, though. Eve had always been a private young woman. The only time he'd seen her break down was the time she'd cried in his office. Even at her mother's funeral, she'd been controlled, almost calm.
"Of course," he said, thoughts of the meal forgotten. "Lunch at George's in the Sandpiper?"
There was a moment's hesitation.
"That's still a bit close to home."
"I'm planning to go into Barnstaple anyway. Why don't we meet in the cafe at the Woodyard? It's not too busy at the weekend."
"That would be perfect."
He could sense her relief.
"Half an hour?"
"Well, that might be a bit optimistic with the traffic," he said.
"But yeah, I'll get there as soon as I can."
Once the place had been a timber yard, putting together door and window frames and shipping them all over the country. When it had first become a part of Jonathan's life, the yard had been derelict for years, the warehouses crumbling behind a high-security chain fence. There had been plans to clear the empty buildings and replace them with a new retail park, but the shops on the high street were already struggling for survival, and Jonathan had seen the site's potential. His vision had created the Woodyard, an arts centre with spaces for performance and exhibitions. It housed a community choir and a youth theatre, and a day centre for people with learning disabilities. The cafe had a view over the river. The sliding doors to the terrace had been opened, and most customers were sitting outside. Lucy Braddock, a woman with Down syndrome who worked part-time as one of the waitresses, was clearing tables. She gave him a little wave and a huge smile. Eve was there before him. She'd chosen a table inside in a corner, hidden by a pillar. As soon as he saw her, Jonathan could tell that she'd been crying. He gave her a hug. Her shoulders were rigid, could have been formed from twisted wire. They sat for a moment in silence. There was no need to ask her what was wrong. She'd tell him when she was ready. Staying quiet was one of the skills he'd learned from Matthew.
"I think I met your husband today," she said at last. "You did tell me he's called Matthew and that he works as a detective."
"Yes, he was called out to a case earlier this morning."
This wasn't at all what he was expecting.
"He's at Westercombe, at the farm."
She looked up.
"I only saw him briefly, but he seems very nice."
Her voice was horribly controlled.
"It was a woman who spoke to me."
"Oh, that will have been Jen Rafferty."
She nodded.
"Somebody killed my father," she said. "Stabbed him with a piece of my glass. I found him in my studio early this morning."
"Oh, love!"
The shock seemed a little like a stab. It was as if the blood was draining from his face, and he felt almost that he was about to faint. How must Eve have reacted to finding Yo, to a horrific scene in the place where she was at her most creative? She was closer to her father than he had ever been to either of his adoptive parents. He'd envied the relationship she and Nigel had shared. He pulled his chair closer to hers and held her in his arms again. He couldn't believe that an hour earlier he'd been obsessing about the ingredients for Sunday lunch, that choosing the right menu had seemed the most important thing in the world.
"Do you want to tell me what happened?"
"I don't know," she said. "That's the worst thing, not knowing what happened or why. It seems so random. Everybody liked my father, he was a good man. And yet, a piece of my glass killed him, caused all the blood. I know it's irrational, but I feel somehow responsible."
Jonathan didn't know what to say. Usually words came easily to him. He held her hand for a moment. It felt tiny, the bones thin like a small bird's, and it fluttered as if it were separate and alive. At last he spoke. "Matthew will find out. That's what he does. It's almost who he is." Gently she pulled her hand away.
"I should go back. I can't run away forever.
Do you want to come and stay with us for a while?"
The words came out on impulse. She thought for a moment.
"Not today," she said. "I need to be on my own now. But I might take you up on the offer, in a couple of days, maybe."
"Any time. Really, any time."
Chapter 7. Jen stood outside Westercombe Cottage, rang the bell and waited. The cottage was like something out of a child's picture book,
with low eaves and a thatched roof, but Jen didn't appreciate its beauty. It was early afternoon and she was starving. Breakfast seemed an age away. Sarah Grieve opened the door and stood blocking the way, silent and implacable. "I'm sorry to disturb you," Jen said, "but I do need to ask some questions." "It's not convenient." "Eve's dad is dead. Someone stuck a piece of glass in his neck. He bled all over her studio floor. That was more than inconvenient." Jen stopped speaking and thought she'd ruined any chance she'd had to build a relationship with the woman. Even Ross would have done better, and Matthew would be furious. But something about this woman and missing lunch and the remnants of a hangover had got under her skin. She was about to apologize when Sarah Grieve stood aside. "I suppose you're just doing your job." "The first few hours are important," Jen said. "We need to talk to you all." It was a dark hall, coats piled onto hooks, boots and shoes spilling out of a rack. "You'll have to excuse the mess." The words were automatic. There was no sense that Sarah really cared what Jen thought about the state of her house. There was an open door leading into a kitchen. A tall, good-looking man with an impressive beard and two small girls in shorts and t-shirts sat at a scrubbed pine table. They'd been eating lunch, and the remains of the meal were crammed at one end. At the other stood a pile of files, a basket of knitting wool, a doll with one arm, and stray pieces of Lego. The man stood up, stared. Jen picked up hostility. Was this how he always reacted to strangers in his home? "This is one of the detectives," Sarah said. "She wants to ask us some questions." "I need to get back to work." But John Grieve hovered where he was. He didn't move towards the door. "It won't take long." The window in the room was small and there was no direct sunlight. After the brightness of the courtyard, it seemed very dark. Even in this heat, there was a faint smell of damp. The cottage might be idyllic from the outside, but it was cramped for a family of four. Jen was still struggling to make out all the detail in the kitchen. There seemed to be nowhere for her to sit. "Why don't you go and play?" Sarah said to the children. "You can use the laptop in our bedroom. Just half an hour." This seemed an unexpected treat, and the girls ran off. "We don't usually allow them screens." Sarah sat on one of the chairs and nodded for Jen to join them at the table. Jen thought briefly that if she had been any kind of mother, she'd have limited her kids' access to the internet, but it was too late for that now. Ben could barely make it through dinner without recourse to his phone. John Grieve returned to his chair. No move was made to clear the breadboard, the rinds of cheese, the wilting salad. The woman leaned back in her chair. "So, what do you need to know?" "Did you hear or see anything unusual last night, or the early hours of this morning?" The couple looked at each other. Jen couldn't work out what was going on. Some secret message passing between them? But they must have known the question would be asked, and they would have had time to work out a story. "I was in bed by 10, John Grieve said. "I have to be up early for milking." "I was later," Sarah said. "Frank wanted something in writing on the changes we're planning to make to the dairy. I thought I'd make a start while it was clear in my head." "What time did you finish?"
"Midnight, maybe a bit after."
"Did you hear a car in the yard? We know Nigel drove to Westercombe last night. At least his vehicle is here." Sarah shook her head. "I was listening to music and had headphones on so I wouldn't wake the kids." "You didn't see headlights?"
"No, sorry. I was pretty focused on the screen."
Grieve looked up. "I noticed Nigel's car when I went out to the cows this morning. I thought he'd had an early start."
"You didn't see him?"
"No, I thought he'd be in the flat with Eve."
"Nothing unusual at all?"
"Sorry." John Grieve got to his feet. "Look, I've got to go. It's a busy time." He gave a brief nod to his wife and left the room. Through the kitchen door, Jen saw him pulling on his boots in the hall, and there was a sudden flash of sunlight as he went into the yard. In the cluttered room, there was silence. Jen waited. She thought the woman might have more to say. Everything was still. She felt for a moment like a character in a gloomy Dutch painting, all brown interiors and rotting fruit. Her friend Cynthia fancied herself an expert in art and dragged Jen around visiting exhibitions occasionally. The silence stretched until at last Sarah spoke.
"Everyone thinks it's paradise living here.
We're almost rent-free because I look after the big house for Frank when he's not around, and he gives Wes and Eve a great deal too. But it's not without its difficulties, living practically on top of each other. This place might look pretty, but it's a bit low on mod cons, and Frank isn't always easy.
In what way not easy?
This wasn't Jen's idea of paradise. She could imagine it in the winter when the westerly gales came hurtling off the Atlantic, the place all drafts and mud.
Wouldn't that attract vermin? Mice? Rats, even?
Another silence, only broken by laughter from the girls upstairs. He's full of principles, which is great if you're minted, but not so easy for the rest of us.
You're thinking of the tea shop idea?
Well, yeah, but there are other things too, which get under John's skin. It makes for a tense situation, and John's not the best at coping with stress. Frank's passionate about animal welfare and the whole organic thing. We are too, but there needs to be some flexibility. It's as if he actually wants to lose money on the venture. We can't have that sort of attitude. We've got the girls to think about, and this new little one.
She patted her belly.
Is Mr. Lay a relative of yours?
His mum was my grand sister. I called her Auntie Nancy. I visited the farm when I was a kid. Frank was already working in London then, and the place was falling apart. His dad died not long after the crash, and Frank came along with all that money to bring it back to life.
She paused. Nancy only died a few years ago. She was in her 90s, still sparky, still active. She had a heart attack after a day of gardening and died in her own bed. Frank was devastated, but I know that would have been how she'd want to go. That was when I took on the role of housekeeper, as well as working in the dairy.
You must be knackered, with the kids to look after too?
Sarah gave a little grin.
Yeah, that's my world, permanently knackered.
She didn't seem thrown by it, though.
What does your husband make of it all?
Another silence.
John finds it tricky, Sarah said at last. He'd rather we were more independent, able to do our own thing.
He doesn't have an arty bone in his body, so the whole setup here, Wes treating the place like a commune and bringing his mates to stay, impromptu gigs in the yard when we're trying to sleep, that's not really his bag. Like I said, he's not good with stress.
And you? Is it your bag?
Honestly? It is, really. I love the buzz and the company. I'm not sure how I'd cope doing the traditional wife thing miles from anywhere in a hill farm on the edge of Exmoor. And that's John's dream.
Jen thought about that. She could see how that might cause problems for the couple. She'd be with Sarah every time.
Before she could speak, the woman continued.
I'd give it a go, though. Only fair. We've done my thing since we moved here, and now we're saving like fury to find our own place. That's why the tea shop is so important.
Jen nodded to show she understood.
How well did you both know Nigel?
I lived in the same street as Eve when I was growing up. I was a few years older, but she was brighter, and we were best mates. In and out of each other's houses. Both only children. So I've known Nigel since I was a kid. He still lives in the same house in Barnstable. John met him a few times when we first married. He came to our wedding, but only really got to know him when we moved in here. For the first time, Sarah seemed to notice the food left on the table. She pulled herself to her feet and began, haphazardly, to move plates towards the sink. In a way, they were very similar. Both quiet men, both competent, no need to show off, none of that macho crap. They liked each other. John might not show it, but he's upset.
She turned to face Jen.
I loved Nigel. He was like a second father. When I was growing up, I could tell him stuff that I could never tell my parents.
Just find out what happened.
For Eve and for us.
No pressure then.
Jen nodded and got to her feet.
Chapter 8. It was late afternoon and Matthew ordered Jen and Ross back to Barnstable.
Get something to eat, then make notes of initial witness responses to share with the team. Ross, please could you do an internet search of all the residents at the farm? Any criminal convictions? And let's see if we can have a first report on our victim's phone records. Eve has given us the details of his mobile provider. Jen, any social media activity or news reports around Dr. Yeo? His work could sometimes have been controversial, occasionally high profile if he'd started taking on his former employees in the health trust. We'll clear out of the way at Westercombe now and leave the place free for the CSIs and the search team.
Let's meet in the office for a briefing at 6. Sal Pengelly has agreed to fast-track the post-mortem and we'll carry that out later this evening, if it's at all possible. I'll be there for that. He paused and looked at them both to check they'd registered the instructions. Ross, can you get a lift back with Jen and leave me the car? I'll just call into the Sandpiper where Janie McKenzie works on my way back to town and check Wesley's alibi. And find out a bit more about Mac, the young man who killed himself. Case Nigel was working on when he died. When he arrived, there was nowhere to park on the street close to the Sandpiper, and the only place he could find was outside the Glorious Oyster, the fish shack and kitchen behind the dunes. A customer was sitting at the picnic table outside, carefully poking the flesh from a crab's leg, completely absorbed. Matthew knew Lindsay, the owner, because this was one of his and Jonathan's favourite places to eat, and she waved agreement when he asked if he could leave the car.
I'll be packing up soon anyway. It's been manic and we've almost sold out.
He walked back to the bar through hordes of families, people greasy with sun cream or pink with the heat. At the Hocking's ice cream van, there was a queue which led over the low wall and down to the beach. Suddenly, Matthew was shot back in time to his childhood. His mother had disapproved of any form of processed food. The good Lord created my body and it's a sin not to take care of it. But his father, who'd only converted to the Brethren to be married to her, had been less rigid. If they were out walking together, they'd both enjoy a vanilla cone with a flake whenever they came across a Hocking's van. His father would wink.
Our secret, eh?
Matthew had been a bit of a prig when he was a boy and hadn't quite approved of the deceit. He'd never turned down the ice cream, though, and now he regretted that he hadn't been more relaxed, that he hadn't been able to enjoy those shared moments with his father more. The man had died a few months before, and the opportunity had been missed. As soon as he reached the Sandpiper, he realised that he'd made a mistake. He'd thought there might be a quiet spell between the afternoon teas and the first beers of the evening, but the place was heaving. People were sitting on the wall that separated the pavement from the beach already drinking. Inside, there was a queue at the counter that reached out into the street. The noises from the coffee machine, raised voices and raucous laughter battled against each other and made his head ache. He was bombarded by a sensory overload and felt completely out of place. Like the Glorious Oyster, this was somewhere he'd come with Jonathan, but only in the evening when it was quieter, more intimate, to listen to the music. He stood at the door, thinking he'd go away and make a proper appointment to come back, when George McKenzie saw him. He waved at Matthew and yelled so his words were quite clear, even from the other end of the room and over the background noise of the bar.
I heard about Nigel. Come round to the yard.
Matthew reached the yard via an alley at the side of the building and through a wooden gate. The bolt was on the other side, and even he had to stretch to reach it. This wasn't a place for punters. It held empty kegs and crates of wine bottles, and the concrete floor was scattered with cigarette ends. The yard must be an unofficial staff smoking area. Through an open window, Matthew saw the kitchen, heard shouts for service and the banging of pans. George was already there, leaning in the shade against the high wall.
Sorry about the surroundings.
He hadn't lost the Scottish accent after years working in the South. This is the only place we'll make ourselves heard. He looked up at Matthew.
I can't believe it. Who would have done such a thing?
We don't know yet. None of the details are very clear. Matthew was deliberately vague. Everybody speaks very highly of Dr. Yeo. Did you know him well?
Not personally, not as a friend. He was investigating the circumstances surrounding my son's suicide.
I heard that. Matthew paused. Frank Lay told me. Another silence. I wondered why Frank was so closely involved with your boy.
Two oddballs together, maybe.
The words came out quickly, and immediately George seemed to regret them. I loved my son, of course I did, but I never understood him. He was different, even as a child. Intense, given to obsession, anxious. And Martha? What did she make of him?
Ah, my lovely Martha.
George sighed. There was something theatrical about every response.
She's not what anyone would call maternal, and when Mac was growing up, she was hardly ever here. She was in that soap opera about the doctor's practice. It was shot in Bristol, and she spent most of her time there. Sometimes I felt that her life was all about filming schedules and rap parties.
She's retired from acting now, though. The last time Matthew had been at the Sandpiper for an evening of music, Martha McKenzie had been front of house, still glamorous, propping up the bar, inviting attention. More attention, it seemed, than the singer on the low stage.
Well, let's say that acting has retired her. If an offer came through, I know she'd jump at the chance. A pause and a wry smile. I know where I come on her list of priorities, but she's too proud to go begging for work.
Was she here when Mac died?
Yes, and she was devastated, of course. We all were.
I did wonder, Matthew chose his words carefully, if there might be more than friendship between Frank and Mac.
You thought they might be lovers, George said, or that Frank might have groomed him. Mac was only 19 when he died, after all.
No, I never suspected anything of that sort. Frank's a kind man, and they were kindred spirits, both loners struggling to make sense of the world.
We would have been happy if Mac had found a partner. There were girls he fell for, but the relationships never survived. I think he scared them off by being too intense, too demanding, too unstable.
Is your daughter around?
Yeah, Janie's behind the bar, working. Can you talk to her when it's not so busy? You can see what it's like in there.
Was she working yesterday night?
George shook his head. Nah, she asked for the night off, and I thought she deserved a break. This weather's great for business, but it's been relentless. He was at a party in Barnstable. Wesley up at Westacombe took her along.
He gave a little laugh. When she got home, she said that she'd have had a better time staying here. The partygoers were all closer in age to her mother and me. She likes a real bash, our Jeanie, something a bit livelier.
She gave Wesley a lift home.
Well, as far as the turn off to the farm. She made him walk up the lane, to serve him right, she said, for the boring evening.
Matthew nodded. So far, Wesley's story was confirmed.
What time did she get back?
I'm not sure. I was still in the bar when she got here, so 12:30 maybe? I'd just finished the last of the clearing up. Janie hadn't been drinking because she was driving, so we shared a nightcap.
He nodded towards the house on the other side of the wall.
You know we live next door.
Matthew nodded again. One of my officers will be back tomorrow to take a statement from her.
When's the best time to come?
Early afternoon, maybe. We do brunch on a Sunday instead of lunch, and things should be quieter by then.
Mention of Sunday lunch gave Matthew a jolt. The following day was his mother's birthday. She would be coming to the house and Jonathan would be cooking. He experienced the sense of dread, of social anxiety that had been part of his life since he'd left the Brethren. He'd lost his faith suddenly and publicly and had been cast out by the people he'd thought had cared for him most, his parents and his friends. The group talked of unfellowshipping, and despite knowing rationally that he'd only been honest, there had been times when he'd felt unworthy of human contact. The sense of loss had haunted him when he was a student and at the beginning of his working career. Only Jonathan had given him the confidence to face the world. It occurred to Matthew fleetingly that the investigation would give him an excuse to cancel, but he imagined what Jonathan would say if he called the meal off. He'd face accusations of cowardice. Murder or not, he'd have to be there. He turned his attention back to Mackenzie.
How do you and Frank Leigh know each other? You didn't grow up here. How did he get so fond of Mac?
The question seemed to surprise Mackenzie. He'd thought the conversation over.
Frank helped us out.
George, usually so urbane and relaxed, was almost embarrassed.
3 years ago, we were going through a difficult time financially. We were more of a traditional cafe than breakfasts, lunches, and afternoon teas. Martha had just been dropped from the telly show, so no regular income and no savings. She spent everything she earned as it came into her account. It was desperate, actually. There was a chance we'd lose the business. Leigh had bought up a restaurant 2 doors away and they were taking all our lunchtime business. I was furious and got in touch with him. He asked me up to Westacombe, came down specially from London for the meeting.
George paused. It wasn't what I was expecting. I had my pitch already, had managed to stoke up the righteous indignation, but in the end, he just listened.
And he invested.
Yeah, he invested. But more than that, he came up with ideas. Or he got me to come up with ideas. You don't seem that enthusiastic about the place, not passionate. Ideally, what sort of business would you like to run?
I'd expected a half-hour confrontation, but I was there all evening, drinking his very good wine on the terrace, watching the sun go down over the estuary. I started talking about music, Martha's experience of the theatre, all her contacts, and he came up with the plan. Seems to me you should turn the sandpiper into a performance space. I'd put money into that. And he did.
He was right, Matthew said. It's what makes this place unique. How does it work? Are you partners?
George shook his head. He gave us a loan, interest-free. We paid it back after the first year, but we became friends, and he's still there if I feel I need advice or to share ideas.
And that's how he got to know Mac. Through you.
That first night, we didn't just talk about the business. As I said, he was a great listener. He could have been a shrink or a priest. I talked about the family, about Mac and his problems. Mac was 16 and struggling at school, in danger of permanent exclusion. Frank said he needed someone to look after the garden. Maybe Mac would be interested in the work. Only weekends, and it wouldn't need anyone skilled. Someone to mow the lawn and keep the beds weeded. His mother, Nancy, had designed it all, and Frank wanted to keep it going in her memory. Their friendship started like that.
George paused. When Mac died, it was as if Frank had lost part of his family.
He was as upset as we were.
A pause.
He asked to speak at the funeral and had us all in tears.
So he got Nigel to look into the circumstances surrounding the suicide.
George nodded. Frank has a way of making things happen.
Perhaps money can do that. It helped that someone was taking our concerns seriously. We knew we couldn't bring Mac back, but there were all those unanswered questions about his care.
His voice tailed off.
Matthew understood how stretched the community mental health teams had become. His police officers seemed to be the first point of call for troubled people these days. Time, which in the past had been used to investigate burglary, was now spent tracking down a response from the community mental health team or driving to A&E. He wondered if Mac's care had been any worse than that of other young people similarly struggling with depression or addiction. He looked at his watch. It was getting late, and soon his team would be gathering for the briefing. And still, he hadn't eaten.
Thanks, he said. I'll let you get back to the fray.
He was about to ask if George could get him a sandwich to take away, but that would have meant jumping the queue at the counter. His principles, as strange and as rigid as those of his mother, couldn't quite allow him to do it. They were gathered in the ops room in Barnstable Police Station. The building was brutalist concrete and scheduled for redevelopment. The Civic Centre had already moved on to other premises, and sometimes Matthew felt as though they were stranded, forgotten by superiors nearer to the centre of things. North Devon still felt isolated and miles from the mainstream. He'd picked up a sandwich and bad coffee from a service station on his way back into town, consumed them too fast in his office, and was almost the last to get to the room. Matthew stood at the front and waited for the team to settle. It didn't take long. They'd learned by now that he wasn't a man for shouting to get attention. He was patient, and most police officers weren't. They nudged the colleagues still talking until everyone was quiet. He didn't shout when he was addressing the team either. They had to sit close to him, and they had to listen carefully. Our victim is Dr. Nigel Yeo, a former doctor at the North Devon Hospital, who worked with a small organisation which represents patients' views and experiences to the Health Trust, the governing body of the hospital. He seemed to have broadened the brief and had started following up complaints about care. North Devon Patients Together is based in Ilfracombe, and he headed up a small team of four people. Matthew had gained the last piece of information from the organisation's website. His body was found by his daughter, Eve, in her studio at Westercombe Farm. Eve's a glassblower, and she'd expected her father to come early on Saturday morning to help her work. But by early, she meant 7:30. It seems likely that death actually occurred at about 1 in the morning, because a witness says he saw a car driving at speed down the lane towards the coast. The lane only leads to Westercombe. As yet, we have no idea what might have taken Nigel to the farm late yesterday evening or in the early hours of this morning. In the front row, Ross May had stuck up his hand. He looked young and eager, a schoolboy trying to impress a teacher.
Matthew thought the constable had realised that his mentor and guardian, Superintendent Joe Oldham, would soon be forced into early retirement and was trying to curry favour with his more immediate superior. As soon as this idea came into his head, Matthew thought he was being unfair. With more experience, Ross would make a good detective.
Yes, Ross. Might we have more of an idea of the time of death after the post-mortem?
The irritation deepened. This was going over old ground, a lesson not properly learned.
Most unlikely. Can anyone tell me why?
Jen answered immediately.
Research shows that it's impossible to pinpoint time of death with any accuracy.
Matthew gave her a little smile.
Quite right, as Dr. Pengelly never fails to tell us. So we have to rely on old-fashioned policing, not a pathologist's magic or guesswork.
Jen, you were actually the last person we know to see Dr. Yeo alive. What time was that?
It was at a party held by Cynthia Pryor in Newport. I can't be positive about the time, but I'd say between 10:30 and 11 p.m.
She looked at Matthew for understanding.
I'd had a few drinks. I wasn't looking at my watch.
Can you talk to any of the other guests, see if we can pinpoint it more precisely? Or find out if he told anyone what his plans were for the rest of the evening?
Yeah, sure.
Although Wesley Curnow, another of the Westercombe residents, claims to have seen the vehicle leave the farm in the early hours, we can't assume that the killer was someone from outside. Curnow could have made up the story, or the car might have strayed up the track by mistake. So we need more information on the residents. Ross, you were going to do a background check.
Ross stood up and faced the room, practicing, Matthew thought, for the promotion he felt he deserved. Then he chided himself again for his meanness of spirit.
Wesley Curnow, aged 42. He's been cautioned once for possession, cannabis, a small amount. The officer assumed it was for personal use.
A moment of silence to express his disapproval.
No other offences apart from road traffic violations, one for speeding and one for bald tyres. As far as I can see, he's never married and never had children. Evio, our victim's daughter, hasn't been involved with us in any way. Neither has the couple who live in the cottage, John and Sarah Grieve, or the house owner, Francis Lay.
Thanks, Ross.
It was as much as Matthew would have thought, and didn't take them any further forward.
I have managed to pry some info out of his mobile provider. Calls and texts were much as you'd think. Lots to his daughter. I haven't had a chance to look at all the others in detail, but there's one recurring number which appears even more frequently, to someone called Lauren Miller.
The name seemed familiar to Matthew. He remembered he'd seen it on the NDPT website.
She was one of his colleagues at Patients Together. You'd expect that.
Some of them were very long calls, made late at night.
Ross allowed the implication to sink in before taking his seat.
Oh, that is worth following up. But of course, we won't jump to conclusions.
Matthew paused.
Did Yeo take any calls yesterday evening? Something must have prompted him to go to Westercombe that late at night.
Ross shook his head.
Last one was to Lauren Miller late afternoon.
Matthew thought about that. So there'd been no urgent last-minute call summoning him to Westercombe. He turned to his sergeant.
Jen, did you dig out anything interesting?
There's loads of archive news material on Lay. You just have to Google and you come up with pages of the stuff. He made his fortune by selling the shares he'd bought cheaply in the years immediately before the financial crash, but there's no evidence of him breaking any rules. He doesn't seem to have been involved in anything dodgy. He just recognised the risks before other people. I had an interesting conversation with Sarah Grieve this afternoon. Her husband's desperate to move away from Westercombe to some Exmoor Hill farm, but she's not so keen. She likes the arty setup and would miss her mates, especially with a new baby on the way. She caught Matthew's eye. I'm not sure how relevant all this is, but I know you like background.
Oh, I certainly do. Gossip is our friend.
He scanned the room. I'm tied up over lunchtime tomorrow, important family occasion.
Jen, can you talk to the partygoers, see if we can get a precise time of Nigel's leaving and some idea of what took him to the farm that late?
Ross, I'd like you to head round to the Sandpiper. Apparently early afternoon is best. I talked to George McKenzie today, but his daughter wasn't available. We need a statement to confirm Curnow's story, but also anything she might have on the Westercombe residents.
I'll see what I can make of Nigel Yeo's home. He might have kept work records there. I can do that early in the morning. Leave Jonathan the kitchen to himself. Still be back for lunch. The nauseous sense of dread about his mother invading his home ground returned. He smiled at the team, sent them on their way, and made his way to the hospital mortuary, where Sally Pengelly and the corpse of Nigel Yeo were waiting for him. Chapter 9. Eve didn't go straight back to the farm after meeting Jonathan at the woodyard. She couldn't face Sarah's smothering love, Wes's awkward pity. She had another coffee after the centre manager left, then chatted for a moment to Lucy Braddock, whose smile could light up any room. Eve started crying again, despite herself.
"Are you all right?" Lucy asked.
"Not really. My dad just died." She saw a shadow pass over Lucy's face and the smile fade, because Lucy's dad was in his 80s and Lucy was aware that nobody lived forever. Eve gathered up her bag and made her way to the car. There'd been no shade left to park in, and it was roasting inside, the seat burning even through her dungarees, the steering wheel almost too hot to touch. On impulse, she went to the woodland burial site, where her mother had been put to rest in a willow coffin. It was inland from Barnstable, on the back road to Ilfracombe, a small copse of newly planted trees close to the river. She and her father had planted a sapling on top of the grave, and their friends had given a lusty rendition of Yellow Submarine, led by Wesley. She and her father had chosen the song. It was what they'd always sung on journeys when she'd been a child, and this, they'd decided, was a journey of a kind. There were no stones or memorials, but she knew where the grave was. The last time she'd visited, she'd been with her father, and there were pools of bluebells. Sitting in the shade, with the noise of the river running low over pebbles, it was her mother she thought about now. Helen had been a medic too, a GP, passionate about her patients and a furious activist fighting for the NHS. Spiky and funny, given to bright, unprofessional clothes and angry letters to the papers. It was Helen who'd first suggested her husband should consider taking on a new role, her tone flippant, only half serious. Eve had just come home from Sunderland after completing her MA, and she remembered the discussion. They'd been sitting at the dinner table, eating beef bourguignon, cooked in her honour, drinking smooth red wine. After a student house in the northeast, it had felt wonderfully luxurious. "You need a new challenge," Helen had said to her husband. "You're starting to get bored." "You're not suggesting retirement, are you? Can you imagine?" They'd all laughed, but perhaps that conversation had sown a seed, given Nigel permission later to give up medicine. Not long afterwards, Helen had started to notice the first signs of early-onset Alzheimer's. She'd gone secretly to a specialist for tests, kept the panic to herself until she was sure of the diagnosis, excluding them both. Then there'd been another dinner. More good food, more wine. A revelation which would change all their lives. "I could tell I was losing it," Helen had said. "The first tests weren't conclusive, but I knew." And there had been another discussion about Nigel's future. "I'm thinking of applying to head up Patients Together." He'd taken Helen's hand across the table. "You said I needed a new challenge." "You're doing it because you think I'll need a carer." "I'm thinking of it because I want to spend more time with you. That was what we always planned for this stage in our life. This'll be office hours, no ridiculous shifts." There'd been a silence. Eve had felt herself holding her breath, waiting for her mother's reply. Certainly she'd been trying to hold back the tears. "Your decision," Nigel had said, his attention completely focused on Helen. For the first time in her life with her parents, Eve had felt in the way, that she was intruding. Helen had nodded. Decision made. "Of course, there's no guarantee that I'll get the job." "You'd better fucking get it." At that point, Helen had still been very much herself. The illness had taken hold very quickly, and soon Helen had become frail and confused. There'd been occasional flashes of her old self, but they'd become scarcer. Her mood had swung between frustration and good humour. But Nigel had always been there, patient and uncomplaining.
Eve had often visited, of course, and Helen had seemed pleased to see her. There had been moments of laughter. One day, however, she arrived and Helen had treated her as a stranger. She died soon after, only months after Nigel had taken over his new role at Patients Together. A relief, everyone agreed, that it hadn't dragged on, that she hadn't had to go into care. But Eve knew her father hadn't seen it like that. She'd wondered if he'd go back to a post in the hospital, lose himself in medicine again, but Helen had wanted him to take the job in NDPT, and so he'd stuck to it. Now, as a slight breeze brought some relief from the heat and moved the leaves above her, scattering light across the undergrowth, Eve wondered if that decision was what had killed him.